From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
Well, in light of Park City's recent misadventures with a black bear running around town, we're going to spend the first half of the show talking all about bears, both local and global. We'll be speaking with Thomas Sharp, an ecologist with SWCA Environmental Consultants in Salt Lake City. He's also a research biologist with the nonprofit Wildlife SOS and a member of the IUCN's specialty group on the Sloth Bear Expert Team.
Wow, that's all in the first half of the show.
That's right.
All right, and then in the second half, we'll talk Wasatch Back Trees planted 2,000 Douglas fir tree seedlings last week at the Canyon Ski Resort. Jason Bartow is a certified arborist and member of Wasatch Back Trees, and he'll come on to tell us how it went, where the trees were planted, and why.
We'll also discuss with him other activities and plans the Wasatch Back Trees has for this summer, as well as the challenges our trees face from warming temperatures, lower precipitation, and bark beetles.
All that and some news on water, of course. Why not?
Always.
We had a big storm last night, but that's just one, and we still have a drought going on here. And we have a water waste competition or contest you listeners can get involved in. Go out, take a photo of somebody wasting water, email it to the station, and we'll put it on the website. We'll give you the details on how that works. And I've got some water wasters to share. I'm naming names.
Chris is ready to go, so watch out. You can join in on today's conversation with both of our guests by posting to our Facebook page, KPCW This Green Earth. Our connections with and impacts upon the environment. That's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us.
This is Nan Worrell from the People's Health Clinic on behalf of Vail Resort's Epic Promise, supporting KPCW. When local teachers said that kids were having a hard time learning because they couldn't see the chalkboard, Epic Promise helped us launch a new program that provides eye exams and glasses to children who can't afford them. Thank you, Vail Resort's Epic Promise, for the new vision program and helping local kids have a bright future.
This is Doug Wells, proud supporter of KPCW with Albion Financial Group, Utah's 25-year-old boutique wealth management firm. Albion manages just under $600 million for about 300 families in Park City and the Intermountain West by navigating legacy issues and managing their portfolios on confidential terms. 649-1717 or albionfinancial.com.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson, and that's Chris Cherniak across the board. And in the studio with us this morning is Thomas Sharp, and he's here from SWCA Environmental Consultants in Salt Lake, where he's an ecologist. And we're going to be talking all about bears. Chris and I wanted to get somebody on the show to talk about bears here locally as well as on a larger scale after the adventures of the past few weeks.
And learn more about.
That's right. What's going on?
What's going on? What is this bear doing here? Why is it here?
Why is he running down our streets?
Exactly.
So Thomas, welcome and thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So let's just kick this right off with discussion of this black bear that was kind of found out and about through multiple neighborhoods in town. Why do these kinds of things happen?
Well, what basically happens is young bears, well, should I start out by talking about the kind of bears we probably have out here, which is going to...
That's a great idea.
Yeah, we assume it was a black bear.
It is a black bear.
Okay. It's not possible to be another type of...
No, the only bear we have in Utah are American black bears.
Okay.
And American black bears, like most bears, are born in their dens during hibernation. And they stay with their mothers for 16 to 18 months.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And at that point, there's a difference between what happens with the females and the male bears. So the young females tend to set up territories near their mother bear, and they form a complex social hierarchy in that area. And the male bears are pushed further out in what we call dispersion. Dispersal of bears. So the bears will disperse across the landscapes, often going for miles and miles. And they often even follow ridgelines to find new areas. And basically they're looking for new territories, possibly new females that they aren't related to potentially breed with.
How much room do they need? What is their territory consist of?
Black bears, since they are omnivorous, and it comes down to food sources.
Okay.
And that's the truth with most bears. So if you can find, say, in Alaska with grizzly bears or with American black bears, they'll have a smaller territory because they have so much concentrated food. Now, in the Intermountain West, with both grizzly bears and black bears, their territories tend to get larger simply because you don't have the food supplies that you do in other places.
And what's their daily diet consist of?
It varies quite a bit. Obviously, berries and, you know, a lot of berries and vegetation matter. They do eat some red meat. I mean, they still are carnivores. So it varies greatly, actually.
So they have a diet kind of similar to us.
Very similar to us, yes. In fact, they're often competing with humans for food in terms of even berry patches or that type of thing. And they also get into human crops and that type of thing as well.
So you also mentioned grizzlies in the Intermountain West. So they exist in this region but not in this state?
That's correct. Grizzly bears did occur in Utah years ago, and they've all been hunted out, as they were throughout most of the western U.S. They really only occur now in very isolated pockets. We call them recovery zones, and the one most people are familiar with, the closest one to here, is the Yellowstone recovery zone.
So this, like, I guess, you know, these healthy populations of bears or expanding populations can kind of cause conflict or fear when they're close to population centers or even, you know, like in parks where people are backpacking on trails and mm-hmm. campgrounds. So you hear all kinds of different advice about how to behave around bears. And I know that probably is a complex question, but, you know, what should you do if you run into a bear on a trail or see one in your front yard?
Well, if you run into one on a trail, the first thing you want to do whenever you see a bear is to assess the situation, probably hold your ground for a second, see if the bear notices you. The thing with black bears, which is what we're dealing with in Utah, is they don't tend to attack defensively. So that usually a black bear is going to run away. Basically, black bears actually evolved with the short-faced bear, which is now extinct, but they're the smaller bear, and so they tend to leave the area. Even if they have cubs, the cubs tend to climb a tree and the mother will actually run away. Now, this varies greatly from grizzly bears, which are larger bear, and they will attack defensively. Now, American black bears will occasionally, it is rare, and I should stress it's rare, mm-hmm. but they will attack predatorily, and this does happen. But there was a paper written just a couple years ago which showed that in the last 110 years, there's only been roughly 60 documented cases of people being killed by black bears. So it's very rare, and there's only been one person killed by a black bear in Utah in the last 110 years.
Wow.
Okay, so you provided us where did this sheet you gave about bear behavior come from?
Yeah, that's from the UDWR site.
So
the Division of Wildlife Resources.
Yes.
And they have some
what to do
and what not to do. And like you say, you should actually stand your ground.
Yes.
So don't, most importantly, don't turn and run.
Correct. Yes.
Because they see that as an opportunity. Okay,
yeah, that can elicit the chase response in bears, and we see that kind of across the board. Obviously, if you're right by your house, it's okay to just scoot back in your house.
Right.
But you don't want to simply break out into a run. Simply hold your ground and see what the bear is doing.
So how, you know, if you're in an area where you have both black bears and grizzly bears, how do you tell the two apart?
That's a good question. Mm-hmm. In some cases, it can actually be difficult. Generally, black bears are black, but that certainly is not across the board. They actually come in several different colors, including cinnamon bears, which look, I mean, the color is quite similar to grizzly bears.
Okay.
And they can actually be a little difficult to tell the difference. The black bears are obviously much smaller. And the grizzly bear has a pretty large hump on its back, which is usually quite noticeable.
Okay.
So go by color first, but just because, you know, it's not 100% because but there are...
It's not right. an easy ID in the field unless you can get a sense of that size.
Yes.
Okay.
Right. But again, in this state, there are no known populations of grizzlies.
That's correct.
And there hasn't been a grizzly bear in this state documented since when?
I don't know the exact year, but it's getting close to 100 years now.
100 years.
Yeah.
But they used to be here.
Yes.
And we kind of push them out. What is the state's policy on grizzlies? Is it closer to their policy on wolves, i.e. we will have no populations of wolves, or is it more akin to deer and elk populations that are, you know, managed
well,
as
for,
game?
For grizzly bears, I'm actually not sure. I'd have to check the UDWR site. For black bears are considered a game animal
okay.
still, and they're still hunted in the state.
They are. Okay. How many bears can I, black bears, can I take a year?
Well, you'd have to apply for the
being
permit.
Being the big hunter that
yeah,
you are.
Just curious.
I don't apply for a hunting license either. But you have to apply to a permit. They
right.
don't just give them out. And there's a limited number. UDWR
yeah.
would have all the details on
okay,
that.
So learn more about that if you're interested in hunting bear, which you can do in this state. Like anything. It's a game.
Yeah.
It's a game animal. Okay, so this bear that was in and around Park City, like Nell was saying, a few weeks ago, was
hanging out
captured,
in gardens, wandering down streets,
yeah,
yeah.
stealing honey pots, the usual things that bears do, and eventually it was captured. But you think that it's probably that was probably a male,
given its.
What it was doing.
Yes,
it was probably a male.
The odds are it was a male. I haven't seen. Well, they obviously caught it. We don't know for sure. But most of the bears that you would find here right now would probably be dispersing young males, roughly 2 to 3 years old, as they're just simply trying to go out and find a new territory.
How old do they live till?
Roughly 20 years. Actually,
wow.
Many bears... What's controlling the length of how long they live is actually hunting in the U.S.
Mm.
The bears that tend to live of old age, what kills them is their feet tend to give out. Their feet just wear out at some point.
Huh.
But we were talking before the show, and I do have a colleague in Minnesota who has a black bear that's in its mid to late 30s already. So they can live a long time.
You say he has one. I mean,
is
a bear in the wild
right.
that he's been tracking.
He's been tracking
for almost 40 years.
Yes.
This is not in his backyard.
No, this is in the wilds of Minnesota.
But it's not unusual for bears to live for almost 20 years.
Yes, naturally they would live about 20 years in the wild.
Okay.
Okay, so talking about kind of like the overall state, I guess, maybe our status mm-hmm. of bears in the West, are they healthy populations? Are they growing? Is it something to be concerned about? Like, you know, are they in any danger of becoming threatened? Or
presently, most populations seem to be slightly increasing. This does obviously vary from area to area.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of states, a lot of different populations in the West. But in general, the populations are going up. And this is also the case on the East Coast as well, where in cities, you know, places like New York, they're getting more and more black bears.
Are these bears becoming more acclimated to humans too? Is there that relationship that they... acclimate to suburban settings?
Yes.
Like some other animals, deer, coyotes, etc.
Yeah, yes. We've talked about it with coyotes and foxes.
Yeah, one of the biggest problems with bears that you don't see with too many other species of wildlife is they get habituated to human environments. And this is bad because they'll get into garbage.
Yes.
And what happens is they begin to see this as their food source. So they'll continually go back, and you'll have bears which are almost eating exclusively, you know, from garbage, this type of thing, instead of actually going in the wild to forage in a natural manner. Unfortunately, these bears often end up dead. They become problem bears, and eventually they are taken out simply mm-hmm. because it's too big an issue. We also have this problem with grizzly bears, in fact, in certain places. So, mm-hmm. yeah, they become very habituated to humans. And unfortunately, in Utah, we don't have many bear-proof containers, this type of thing. We don't seem to be really prepped for this type of thing, probably because there haven't been a lot of black bears around here. They must have been hunted out at some point for the most part.
Right.
And so now we're starting to see some bears potentially coming back. It seems like the population is rising a little in this part of the state. And so we might expect this type of thing to occur a little more commonly, where we're getting young 2 to 3 year old bears looking for a new territory. They follow a ridgeline and they end up in Park City.
on trash day, which is, I think, what happened. It found trash containers. And, yeah.
It's like they're opportunists.
They are opportunists.
You also mentioned that they're called generalists. So talk a little bit what a generalist is.
A generalist, they will take advantage of a lot of different types of habitat, and they'll take advantage of, one of their biggest strengths as a species is they can take advantage of all different kinds of food sources. Bears are very food motivated. So basically they find a good place to get food and they're going to come back over and over again. But yeah, being a generalist, they're able to take advantage of a lot of things that say other specialist animals don't.
Okay. All right. If you just join us, we're speaking with Thomas Sharp. He is a wildlife ecologist with the environmental consulting firm SWCA down in Salt Lake City, right? And Thomas is here talking about bears, all things bears. How did you get involved with bear research and bear studies?
Well, I started working about 12 years ago. This is kind of funny because I started working with bears internationally and then came back to work with them in the States. And the bear that I've been working with, for the most part, has been sloth bears, which occur in India as well as Sri Lanka, Bhutan, Nepal. And it's a very strange bear. They're actually a myrmecophagous bear, meaning they eat termites and ants. They're actually, for a bear, kind of a specialist. Hmm. They don't eat any red meat, but they're actually quite dangerous. Many people are mauled and killed every year. Hmm. And so that's one of the issues we're trying to work with. But we're really involved in the conservation of this species of bear. And when I got involved, they were being poached out of the jungles to basically be danced for money. And so what they would do is they would go in and they would kill the mother bear, take the cubs, and then use them as entertainment. And it was a very cruel practice, but it's all but been ended now in India. Right. But it still occurs in Nepal and kind of on the border of India and Nepal. So we still have programs going on to follow this and try to, knock it out once and for all. But that's where I got started actually working on bears about 12 years ago.
And ever since, it's kind of been just expanding and expanding your involvement.
Yes, yeah. I became a member of the International Bear Association and then a member, like you said, of the bear specialty group. And you tend to meet more people and you get involved to collaborate on other types of projects. So I've been working in other countries as well as working in the United States, even on SWCA projects in Alaska in the West, working on bears and trying to answer bear questions. And so, yeah, it's just kind of expanded.
Yeah.
Your closest call with a bear? Anytime you were in danger?
I don't think I have. In Alaska, one of the islands we were working on, Admiralty Island, there's a bear dump there. Ah. And after dinner, when everybody else would relax, I would go out to the bear dump to watch the grizzlies come in. And there have been some close calls there, but these were habituated bears to the dump, which was really unfortunate.
Right.
So those bears can get a little testy. They're a little different, but I really haven't had any very close calls. And bears generally, and it should be said, are pretty peaceful animals. Even
right.
People think of grizzlies as, these man-eating bears.
Fierce,
and although they can
yeah.
be predatorial, for the most part, these bears are simply going to try to avoid you. And one of the things say in grizzly bear country, which would also work in black bear country, is when you're moving through the woods and making noise, if they know you're coming, they're going to get out of your way. They simply don't want anything to do with you. Mm.
So that's the concept behind, you know, loud talking, bear bells,
exactly.
Those kinds of things.
Make noise.
Yes.
They'll hear you and get out of your way before you see them.
Exactly.
Okay.
So how many species of bears are there in, like, North America?
In North America, there's three.
Okay.
Which would be the American black bear, the grizzly bear, and the polar bear.
Okay.
In Alaska.
Got it.
And then there's one other bear in South America, the Andean bear, which lives in the Andes, as you might expect.
Sure.
And then there's four other bear species in the world. There's the sloth bear, the Asiatic black bear, the sun bear, and the panda bear is still actually considered a bear.
Oh.
Although I hear the Chinese government does not really agree with that. They think it should be something different. But right now it is lumped in with the other bears. It is a bear, although it's a little further out there. It's much less closely related to the other bears.
Okay.
That's interesting. Why would they think that it's not a bear, or they want to reclassify it?
It is a unique species.
Yeah.
And so genetically it is quite different. But still, it still falls within the bear grouping.
General bear family.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So what do you see? We got a couple minutes left. What do you see some of the challenges with respect to bear populations as we go forward? Black, brown, you know, all the species. And all right, we'll have to ask you in terms of the changing climate, too. How will that impact bear populations and bear reach?
That's a great question, and it's a complicated one.
Yeah.
Obviously, with global climate change, as most people are aware, the species everyone is worried about is polar bears.
Mm-hmm.
And this has to do with the melting sea ice and basically the seals on which they prey. So if we're really talking climate change, that's the bear which will probably be impacted the most. I have not personally worked on climate change research with bears. I've been to a few talks on it, and I don't really know the specifics of how it's going to affect grizzlies or black bears.
Mm.
But even with sloth bears in India, some of these areas are so hot, and when they lose their water, we have bears. So basically their environment is drying up, and we have bears which literally are breaking into like PVC water piping just to get water, because
wow.
The bears have nowhere else to go for water.
Mm-hmm.
So that could be also just local changes to the
right.
environment where they're living, as well as climate change.
Well, let me say they're generalists, they're opportunists, and they will acclimate and adapt perhaps better than other species, but they'll still have impacts.
Definitely impacts.
On their winter or summer habitat and ranges.
Yes, exactly. And even with building dens, usually you want to build it in areas of deep snow. That's what grizzly bears are doing. And if you're not getting that kind of snow cover, it's going to affect their cycles and how long they're denning and everything else. Denning is really caused by a lack of food. That's why they go into denning. It's not because of cold. But if there is no food available and they come out of hibernation early, it's a problem. And it can lead to them coming down to human areas to get garbage or whatever.
Okay.
Great. Well, we have to start to wrap up, but give us a couple of resources where people can learn more about these issues with bears. I know you work with several different groups. Maybe mention those names as well.
Well, for Utah, again, I would say, they have a site on living with bears, so I would go to the website for the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources. In terms of the work I'm doing overseas, I'm working with Wildlife SOS, which you can find on the internet, and I also work with groups. Free the Bears is another one, which works in Asia. I've done work with them. And I've also worked with TRACS, which is actually a tiger group in India, but I do a little bear work with them as well. But you can find them on the internet as well. It's TRACTS, TRACS.
And one thing also that the DWR posts on what to do if you have a bear encounter, I just had to ask this one, is about use of bear spray. And it says, Studies have shown bear spray to be 92% successful in deterring bear attacks. You agree? Have you used it? What type of bear spray? What is the bear spray consist of?
Yeah, bear spray works great, actually. And whenever we're in grizzly bear country, yeah. We tend not to use it in black bear country, although we probably should, but it works great. It's actually more effective than using guns. I've been working with a guy named Tom Smith. He's at BYU who has done a lot of research on this. He's actually been working with me on a project in India now, but he would have all the details. But what I do know is this. It's very nasty stuff. And if you're going to carry it, just be careful with it because you don't want to spray it when the wind's blowing in your direction. But it's very effective.
Is it a caustic?
Yes. It's
a certain odor that's
It's
emanated?
Very caustic. It's okay. Made from a certain kind of pepper. And I don't want to say the name wrong.
Isn't it similar to kind of almost like a mace or like a pepper
is it?
Spray?
Oh, okay. But a lot stronger. Yeah, this would work well on people as well as bears.
So this shoots a stream.
Yes, for about 20 to 30 feet.
Wow.
And bears will turn around. It'll stop a grizzly charging. So it's really nasty stuff.
Who tested that?
Not me.
But okay, so bear spray is very effective.
Very effective.
Okay.
So yeah, it's better than guns.
You can pick that up.
It's better than guns.
Okay. Because actually the DWR says if you have to shoot, you shoot to kill.
Right.
If you use a firearm, never fire a warning shot. Aim for the center of the bear and keep firing. If you're going to shoot it, shoot to kill.
Yeah, because they've shown that if you shoot a grizzly that's charging and you don't kill it, it's going to go on and maim you. In fact, it'll probably be more upset.
Right.
And so, yeah, unless you're an incredibly good shot, the odds are you're not going to kill a bear with one shot. So it's actually much safer to use bear spray. And then the bear lives as well. So it's a win-win.
And this one last thing that is fair. It says always.
One more last thing.
I know.
It's so good.
Always fight back.
Yes,
don't
that's interesting.
Okay.
Now, they're right because, again, remember I mentioned that black bears tend not to attack defensively versus grizzly bears. So with black bears, you do want to fight back because the odds are if a bear is attacking you, it's probably a predatorial attack. Now with grizzly bears, it gets more complicated because you have defensive and predatorial attacks. But with black bears, if you're being attacked, chances are the bear wants to eat you. So you don't lie down and play dead. And even with grizzlies, you're not actually playing dead. The bear is simply trying to neutralize a threat, a perceived threat. So you have a grizzly bear with cubs. The mother charges you. She's simply trying to make sure her cubs are safe. She doesn't want, you know, she's just simply trying to neutralize that threat. Once she knows you're not a threat, she'll run off.
Okay.
Okay.
And I don't want to leave this conversation this way that people, we end this conversation with instilling fear because, again, the chances of you being attacked by a bear are extremely remote, much less than the chances of you being hit by lightning, last night's lightning. And there are very few cases, documented cases of bear attacks. So I don't want to, you know, get alarm sound, leave with a kind of an alarmist tone to this.
Yeah.
Okay. So. So it's okay.
That's right. We love our native bears.
Yes. Happy to have them around. Thomas Sharp, he's a wildlife ecologist with SWCA. Thanks again for taking the time and talking.
Thank you.
Educating us all about bears. We'll be in touch. All right.
All right.
Let's take a break for some underwriters.
That's right. And then we'll be back with Jason Bartow of Wasatch Back Trees to talk about some recent planting they did and some upcoming projects.
You got it. It's the Screen Earth. Stay tuned.
This is Chris Robinson with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. KPCW is one of the many nonprofits our agents and companies support. They are the backbone of Summit and Wasatch counties in our incredible community. More info at bhhsutah.com.
Assemble is proud to be a KPCW underwriter. Assemble offers executive offices which can be rented on a long or short-term basis, or a business lounge membership located in New Park. More information on the web at assembleparkcity.com or 435-709-7888.
Hi, this is Reese DeMille with Republic Services. your local source for recycling and garbage service and a proud sponsor of KPCW's This Green Earth. As you recycle, please remember, glass cannot go in your residential curbside recycling bin. Help keep Summit County Recycling clean. SummitCountyRecycles.org.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues, concepts of sustainability. She's Nell Larson, I'm Chris Cherniak, and joining us in the studio is Jason Bartow. He's a certified arborist and member, founder of Wasatch Back Trees.
President,
community
CEO.
Community forester.
Community
forester. I don't want to have an executive title just yet.
All right.
I think that will tie me to a desk.
Community CFO, community forester operator. And he's here to talk, among other things, about an event that you held last week at the Canyons where you planted
2,000 Douglas fir seedlings were planted with the help of several members of the Canyon staff. So we got people had a chance to get away from their desks, from the marketing department and the group sales department and the banquet department and the on the mountain food department, as well as some of the trails crew and some of the sawyers actually that removed some of the dead trees and some of the other trees at the canyon. So it was really a great event where people got to go full circle from being involved with removing and cutting down trees and turning around, you know, reforesting and planting them. It was an awesome event.
Good.
So what was the motivation for the project? Why 2,000 trees? Why now?
Well, we partner with a whole bunch of different agencies. Just about anybody that wants to plant trees, I'm happy to work with. And one of the main groups we work with is the Utah Forestry, Fire, and State Lands. And PJ Abraham, our local forester, had gathered some local Douglas fir seeds from over in the Heber area for another reforestation project he was doing. And I contacted the seedling nursery and said, we'll take your overrun. If you have a successful germination rate from these seeds and you have too many seedlings, we'll take whatever is in excess of that. We didn't want any of these really what we think are good seeds from a really good tree to go to waste. So we ended up with 2,000 of these seedlings. They were relatively small. We call them an S5, probably smaller than that, about 5 inches. S5 standing for 5 cubic inches of soil around their soil plug. And we were kind of floating around to people, you know, where can we put them and who can take best care of them? We've worked with the canyons in the past with replanting willows along East Canyon Creek. We've worked with them with Habitat for Humanity out at the Marion Park in Francis. So I just bounced it off their head and said, hey, do you have a spot, you know, that's roughly around 7,000 feet above sea level, north facing, that could use some trees? And lo and behold, they did. So they also have the capability to give the trees some water. You know, obviously in the last 5 weeks we've had, you know, Mother Nature has given us a good supply, but if it does get dry, these trees could benefit from a drink from the water truck or from the snowmaking system pipe opened up or whatever. So that was part of our motivation in selecting them. And then they also had an on-the-mountain workforce that was able to, you know, assist us with getting the trees in the ground.
So these were in and around the canyons, not just all along the golf course or something?
We planted 400 along the golf course, and then the other 1,600 were planted higher up. There was a realignment where they were disusing an old ski run and moved it over, say, 100 feet. And so we planted our Douglas fir on this old ski run to turn it back into forest. Where they did the new alignment along the cut banks, where a couple trees were removed, we planted them there as well. So we planted in about 4 different areas, actually.
Okay.
And are these Douglas fir some of the same trees that we're already seeing up there in the canyons?
Well, there are Douglas fir at the canyons, and actually the part we planted at down low by the golf course is anchored by four nice large Douglas firs. So we were able to, the volunteers were able to, you know, just look over to the side and see this is what's going to happen in 30 or 40 years.
That was my next question. How long does it take for these to go from 5 inches to, say, 5 feet?
We're happy with between 6 to 12 inches of growth a year.
Okay.
On there, you know, it all depends on how our climate is. This last year's been a pretty good year for growth generally. Once we finally got some moisture in the spring, so, you know, that provides for a stronger year. If we have continued drought and we don't get to see a reprieve, you know, like we did in last May, then you know we're going to see some smaller growth from these trees.
And it's interesting you said that. Planting a tree is great, but knowing where to plant it is really important. And you say that these were north-facing,
yeah,
and at 7,000 feet around that elevation, because otherwise they won't do as well.
Exactly. I mean, it's, you know, to try to have a tree do its best to try to match up the conditions where its genetics allowed it to thrive in on there. We don't always have that luxury a lot of the time. We're relegated to growers that are at lower elevations and mm-hmm. in different climates in the sort. But that's why we jumped on this opportunity, was to be able to take advantage of trees from local genetic stock that have withered some of the onslaughts of pests and the different insects that attack them. So sort of, I almost want to say that we kind of monkeyed a little with natural selection by pulling some strong trees from Heber and bringing them over to our neck of the woods.
Okay. What makes a tree strong, relatively speaking, you know, compared to others that you may see that are more at risk?
Well, I mean, genetics are hard to throw out there. I mean, maybe it has a stronger vascular system.
Okay.
Maybe its genetic makeup allowed its roots to take in faster.
Okay.
So that it can uptake more nutrients and moisture, outcompete its friends. One of the things that key, particularly in conifers, is having sufficient moisture or sap reservoirs or pitch, because when a beetle starts to bore in, the tree, as a defense, will use pitch to kick it back out.
Mm-hmm.
So a tree that has more moisture available has more pitch, or maybe genetically was predisposed to produce that pitch,
right,
and therefore is able to fend off the attack and is still around.
And that's a good point, because as we have drought conditions, that's less water, that makes the trees, even a healthier tree, more at risk to beetle infestation.
Well, to beetle, and you know, this lesson goes to even the trees in our parks, in our houses, along the streets.
Right.
Is that a tree that has less moisture is going to be has a greater chance of being attacked, whether it's a beetle,
right,
or a blight or a scale or any other insects,
mm-hmm.
Or you know, diseases, funguses, molds. Consistently, when I go out and look at trees to see why they're sick or not doing well, it translates back to the amount of water that we were able to get to them to try to keep the trees healthy. And that kind of slides me right into something. Is one of the other projects we're working on right now is removing turf from around trees in some of our public areas, replacing it with wood chips. If you go around and you see grass growing up against a tree, that is not a healthy situation for that tree in there. A tree, if we're walking in the forest, how often do we see nicely manicured lawn? We don't.
Approximately never. So
we see layers of decaying twigs and leaves and pine needles and all sorts of...
Right, maybe some little forbs or...
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's nice to try to recreate that environment for our trees in our community and our urban forest. So we're encouraging people to get rid of the grass and put down wood chips or bark or sawdust or any sort of organic material that's going to, one, suppress the grass... As it decays, it turns into a nice slow-release fertilizer, so now we're not using petroleum-based fertilizers to keep our trees healthy. We're keeping the weed whackers and the lawnmowers away.
Mm-hmm.
We're using less water because we don't need to water that amount of grass. We don't have to cut as much grass. And we're just creating an environment for the trees to be a whole lot healthier.
What kind of distance are we talking?
Well, ultimately, in a perfect situation, out to the drip line or out to the edge of the canopy of the tree is perfect. However, some landscape designs don't allow for that. So we typically try to shoot for an 8-foot circle as a minimum. But any grass that you can get rid of and replace it with wood chips is going to do a lot better job. There's an academic study that came out in the last year and a half that shows double the tree root structure in areas where it does not have to compete with turf.
Wow. So even though it may not be obvious to you that the above ground part of the tree is suffering, it's going to have a much stronger underground system without that turf grass on top.
Exactly. And that translates to what you can see being healthy again. So much of what's important about taking care of your trees and planting them properly is getting a strong root structure, is focusing on what you can't see. And that, in turnaround, usually gives you the benefits of a healthy tree that doesn't require pesticides or herbicides, doesn't require crazy pruning, doesn't have dead branches that are going to turn into a liability, and ultimately, you know, provide the benefits that trees give us, like clean air, clean water, shade, reduced heat, reduced energy.
Yeah. Reason number 36, not
maybe more
to
like
grow.
97.
Yeah, not to grow Kentucky bluegrass, and just and at a minimum, like you say, keep it away from the trees, out to its edge of its canopy, its drip line. We mean where the water rain would fall off its branches.
Yes.
Okay.
The other thing is, people may have noticed, or maybe you will now, is a phenomenon we call mulch volcanoes, where there's 8 to 10 inches of mulch up along the tree and it's resting against the trunk. So in this case, more is not better. A maximum of 4 inches thick layer of wood chips or bark mulch is appropriate. 10 inches is not good. And we also want to keep it about 6 inches away from the trunk of the tree, because that bottom part of the tree is not designed to be moist or, you know, covered by those wood chips.
Okay.
It also can provide camouflage for voles and mice to come in and chew it. So 4 inches thick, and make sure you pull it 6 inches away from the trunk of the tree.
So you brought in a stack of these handy planting guides that include a 2015 Utah preferred tree list for the high altitude region, which probably works for us here in Park City, Summit County, and then also kind of has some nice diagrams on the back of how we should be, the things you were just explaining that we should do, right?
Yes. So this came about, the preferred species list came about from a group that the Utah Community Forestry Council had a subcommittee. So a group of arborists got together, and we basically posed ourselves to the question, which trees would we like to see planted more? So we took in suggestions from all of the prominent arborists in the area. Then we debated and whittled, and it was almost like, you know, making up a fantasy baseball league team. We don't know. We don't
lobbying
want him.
Lobbying for a specific species.
So we want this tree, and no, we don't want this tree for that reason.
Okay.
You can access that list at our website at wasatchbacktrees.org.
Okay.
On there. And it's got 25 cool trees, and it's meant to be a dynamic list. If all of a sudden we find out that one of our species on the list is a terrible idea, for whatever reason, we're open to changing that list out. But we're trying to encourage people to ask their local nursery to order in one of these trees.
Right.
It isn't a tree that you may typically find on the lot when you just show up.
So these, I'm seeing a lot of natives, but not entirely natives. Hmm. There are some other trees that you're recommending work well in this environment. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
The native issue is kind of a tough one for us in our particular climate.
Yeah.
If you want a tall, shady, gorgeous tree, for natives, we're pretty much limited to cottonwoods and willows.
Right.
And those are not necessarily the best landscape trees. They take up quite a bit of water.
Yeah.
They're quick-growing trees, and at some point in their life, they become a structural nuisance. So they're not our favorite trees to see planted out there. So we have to—
In a yard.
That's what I was just going to say. So this is great because it's a great reference of, you know, good options for your yard.
What are some of the non-native species that—
Let's see. We have, like, some—
The Kentucky coffee tree. would be a non-native.
What is that? What is the Kentucky coffee tree? I've never heard of that.
It's a cool tree that has some seed pods on it. You can see quite a few of them down in the Salt Lake Valley.
Okay.
But they're rated cold hardy up to a zone 3. And we think they're a tree that we should plant more of up here and at least see how they're going to do.
See how they do. Another one that caught my eye is the Japanese tree lilac.
Yes.
Because who doesn't love lilacs?
Well, and it's
a... is it a lilac?
It is. Well, it's the flowers are lilac-like, but it's not a... I wouldn't say it's a true lilac.
Okay.
More of a tree form. It's a tree, I think, that does is a really good substitute for crab apples. And crabapple is a tree that does really well in our area, certain varieties of them. Mm-hmm. But I think they're a little overplanted, a little overused. And so if we were to see the crabapple bark borer arrive, like we have, you know, in the Uintas with the bark borers or the emerald ash borer, which is still making its way here. So you won't see any green or white ash on our list there.
Okay.
So we eliminated the ash tree. So... we're not planting something that's going to become fodder for a bug that's probably actually already here. It's been discovered already in Boulder, Colorado, and it's decimated forests back east.
Yeah,
but you said there's populations of it here in the Uintas.
Well, no, I'm talking about the emerald ash borer.
Oh,
Emerald ash borer. Sorry, I segued from the bark beetles in the Uintas to the
bark beetles in the Uintas.
Yes.
But the ash borer is not. Here in the Uintas.
It's not here in the Uintas. We believe it's probably in Utah, just not discovered yet. It's been discovered in Boulder, Colorado, but typically there's about a 3-year lag time from when it's from when it arrives until when it's discovered.
I see. Okay.
So
taking the precautionary principle here, you don't recommend, ash is not a preferred species.
Exactly. That's why it's not on our list there.
Okay, so the next thing I have to ask about is that you walked in here with this gorgeous plank of
wood. I wish we were on TV so we could show people.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm happy we're not.
Jason's doing a Vanna White right now in the studio for us. What is this?
This is a piece of Utah blue pine. And this actually came from a lodgepole pine that was beetle killed in the Uintas. And we grabbed a couple pieces of it from the local lumber mill.
Mm-hmm.
We had it planed and sanded, and this one has a small coat of lacquer on it to make it look a little bit nicer.
Mm-hmm.
So our idea is to show it to local designers, builders, interior decorators, and people, and say, here's an alternative or something to add to your palette to finish the inside of your home with in there. And this piece of wood, if it went to a lumber grader or a lumber broker, would be designated as sort of unusable. It's not gradable because they're looking for something clear and white without any defects in it. But we think that this blue stain that's caused by the fungus that the beetles bring in to feed their larvae, it goes throughout the tree, actually provides some really cool aesthetic qualities to this wood. It makes it really unique.
Yeah.
So we're starting.
Yeah, there's a neat, like, I don't even know how to explain it, like marbling of colors almost. And some of it is what you'd think of as that usual light, whitish wood, and some of it has this gray stain to it.
Now, this is from a tree that obviously was infected. It was harvested post-infection or once dead.
This was dead standing.
Dead standing.
So it was harvested, still usable.
Right.
That's why
the industry would go in and harvest that.
Yes.
Otherwise, they wouldn't want to touch it.
Exactly. Because, I mean, right now, its best use, if it wasn't being used for interior decorating, is firewood.
Mm-hmm.
And that is not necessarily, doesn't pay the bills to build the roads, to, you know,
to make
tear
it
down
worthwhile
the roads, to do all the work that you need to do to safely and economically, environmentally safely harvest timber.
Okay.
So there's a lot of infrastructure work that needs to go in there to harvest this wood. And our idea is if this can be turned into an aesthetic, very cool piece of wood, then our local mills are going to be able to go in there and remove that wood and prevent it at some time is going to be a catastrophe when it burns.
Right.
Well, okay. I'm glad you brought this up. I just got a call the other day at the Swanart Eco Center where I work, and somebody was asking where they could find beetle kill wood locally. So now I've got the answer to that.
Excellent.
I'll send them to you.
That's excellent.
Yeah, yeah.
And again, your website has lots of answers too. So what's that again?
It's wasatchbacktrees.org.
Okay.
There's a contact information and my phone number on it. And if you don't find what you like, please feel free to give me a ring on the phone. And if I don't know the answer, I probably know the person who does.
And shoot, we have like 1 minute. Fruit nuts.
Fruit Nuts.
That's also on the website. What's going on with them?
Fruit Nuts, we're currently partnering with Wasatch Mountain State Park to bring their historic Hoover Grove up to snuff. So we're
awesome.
Removing grass and putting down bark chips and pruning the trees and making them healthier for apple production. So at this point in the game, we're getting our trees prepared, and we're doing doing the same turf removal, wood chip, replacement for the trees that we'll be harvesting from hopefully this fall.
Fantastic.
Learn
more on the website.
Wasatchbacktrees.org.
Or Jason Bartow. He's a certified arborist and the CFO.
CFO, Chief Forestry Officer.
Oh, okay. CFO for Wasatchbacktrees. Thanks for joining us. And we'll see you again.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate
it. More updates. All right. Let's take a quick break for our underwriter, too, and we'll come back. Got a quick news item. It's This Green Earth.
Hi, this is Charlie Taylor with New Park Terrace and Crandall Capital, delighted to support local radio and KPCW. New Park Terrace offers new townhomes with walkable access to shopping, dining, nightlife, public health club, the Park City Trail Systems, and more. Located in the heart of New Park Town Center, more information can be found at newparkterrace.com or 435-602-9995.
This is Renee from Park City Nursery's Landscape Division, expanding your outdoor living space with an ear for style, just like KPCW. Conceptual design, hardscape, fire pits, water features, patios, garden design, and more. High-altitude concepts and plants is our job. We know what grows at parkcitynursery.com.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by Hideout Canyon, Master Plan Community on the Lake, info at hideoutcanyon.com, Long Reimer Weiniger Beppler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
All right, this Green Earth, we got a couple minutes. Want to talk about the Water Waster Contest. That's going on here. The station is hosting it.
That's right, KPCW.
And This Green Earth.
And This Green Earth.
And this is how it works. Go out, take a photo of anyone wasting water.
That's right.
Anywhere. And send that photo, email it to contest@kpcw.org. And with your photo, include why your example of water waste is bad and how you would fix it.
So you don't just get to shame other people. You have to provide a constructive comment.
That's a good point. No, I guess that's makes it a little more difficult for me. But and there will be well, 10 winners will be chosen over the summer, and they'll receive prizes to local resorts, restaurants, and activities. At the end of the summer, one of those winners will become the grand prize winner of $100 in cash.
Cash prize.
And the grand prize winner will be asked on to the local news hour with Leslie Thatcher to talk about their winning entry. So, water wasting.
So keep your eyes out for those sprinklers watering the pavement in the middle of the day. And
those that were running last night.
During the rainstorm.
Over at Racquet Club Village, there was a few on. And then this morning at the Mark.
Uh-oh.
The Mark had its sprinklers on. In and around the pool in the back area. Come on. We had an eighth of inch rain last night on my gauge. So.
Well, you better get out there with your camera.
So mine does. I need to get a camera. All right. That's item number one. Hey, time to wrap up. As usual, thank our guest, Jason Bartow.
With Wasatchback Trees and Thomas Sharp, talking all about bears with SWCA Environmental Consultants.
And, of course, let's thank our sponsors and underwriters who make this show possible. They include Recycle Utah.
Republic Services.
Vail Resorts.
Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties.
And San Francisco Design.
You can also join us on Facebook at KPCW This Green Earth or email us your thoughts at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
This is KPCW 91.9 FM, Park City.
Only in Park City, only on KPCW.
NPR News is coming up.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The White House confirms that Nasir al-Wahishi, the head of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, is dead. In a statement, the administration says Wahishi was killed in Yemen. It says the terror figure was responsible for the deaths of Yemenis and Westerners, including Americans, overseeing the group's operations to attack the U.S. and U.S. interests. The FBI and the Justice Department are investigating the St. Louis Cardinals baseball team for the possible hacking of a database belonging to the Houston Astros. The Houston general manager, Jeff Luhnow, worked for the Cardinals as recently as 2011. In a statement from baseball commissioner Rob Manfred to the New York Times, the commissioner says Major League Baseball has been aware of and has fully cooperated with